Officials in four Ukrainian regions claim victory in referendums held for accession to Russia as the UN reaffirms commitment to Ukraine's integrity. Mayor of London strongly condemns violent protests outside the Iranian embassy as completely unacceptable, saying violence will never be tolerated. And a new study shows bias against Asian women in the U.S. financial sector, with most employees saying that their racial identity hinders their career. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Now, local officials in four Moscow-controlled Ukrainian regions have claimed victory in referendums held for accession to Russia. Officials in southern and eastern regions of Zaporizhia and Kherson, Luhansk, and Donetsk say an overwhelming majority of voters have opted for accession to Russia. Moscow has already said it will give full protection to the regions if they vote to become part of the country. Western countries have slammed the votes as illegal and a sham, saying they will not accept the outcome, whatever it may be. Meanwhile, the UN has reaffirmed its commitment to Ukraine's territorial integrity within its internationally recognized borders. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky also reacted to the referendum, saying Kiev will defend citizens in those regions. NATO's Chief Jens Stoltenberg described the referendums in Ukrainian regions as a sham and blatant violation of international law. According to Russian media, President Vladimir Putin is expected to formally declare the accession of the four regions to Russia this Friday.
From September 23rd to 27th, referendums on joining Russia were held in the Donetsk and Lugansk People's Republics, as well as the Zaporozhye and Kherson regions. Pro-Russian representatives of those regions say joining Russia will secure their territories and restore historical justice. They believe the move is vital in the face of what they call constant acts of terror by the nationalist authorities in Kyiv and NATO countries that supply weapons to Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin has backed the referendums, saying Moscow will support the decision made by the residents of the four regions.
Today, in the context of a special military operation and referendums in Donbas, saving people in all territories, namely saving people in all territories where this referendum is being held, is the main focus of Russia.
The referendum will determine the fate of 8 million people living in the LPR, the DPR, and the regions of Zaporozhye and Kherson.
People are tired and exhausted. They are being shelled and bombed every day. As a result, the residents of these republics ask authorities to hold referendums as soon as possible. Most of them have been supporting joining Russia since 2014. The second reason is the fear of any potential revenge by the Ukrainian regime.
Decisions of this kind and steps are always taken when the situation allows it. All the pros and cons are weighed. It has now become clear that the referendums are in line with the plans that the top leadership of Russia has. The future of Russia's constituent regions is complicated. Western countries will impose sanctions against their residents, like in the case of Crimea. Those regions were degraded under the Ukrainian leadership. Money was not invested in them at all. And now Russia is trying to ensure security and normal life in those territories.
Despite shelling of the territories where the secession referendums were held, the voter turnout was over 80% in all those regions. First partial results show that the overwhelming majority of the residents are in favor of joining Russia.
Most of the voters believe that if a state can join NATO despite Russia's opposition, then disputed Ukrainian regions can join Russia without the West's approval. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Meanwhile, U.S. officials say that they are preparing now a new arms package for Ukraine worth $1.1 billion. Officials say the new package includes HIMARS missile systems, ammunition, various types of counter-drone systems, and radar systems, along with training and technical support. They say the new package will be announced in the coming days. Meantime, the Pentagon has dismissed media reports that it has supplied NASAMS air defenses to Ukraine. The Pentagon says those systems will not be delivered to Ukraine for another 2 months or so. Washington has so far provided over $15 billion in military equipment to Ukraine. That's despite warnings by Russia that Western arms support for Ukraine fans the flames of war. London's mayor has denounced acts of violence by protesters outside the Iranian embassy over the death of Mahsa Amini. Sadiq Khan said what happened was completely unacceptable. He also pointed to clashes between protesters and London police on Sunday. Khan said attacks on police and communities will never be tolerated. The London mayor said a selfish minority who attempted to hijack the protest must be brought to justice. The British police jostled with demonstrators as they blocked roads to the embassy. At least 5 police officers were seriously hurt. 12 people have been arrested on suspicion of violent disorder offenses. And I welcome everyone to our news review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Now, a new study shows bias and racial disparities against Asian women working in the U.S. financial sector. Studies based on a survey conducted and published by nonprofit organization, the Association of Asian American Investment Managers. Almost 60% of employees in investment management from a variety of backgrounds said their racial identity has been a major impediment to their career. The trend of disparity was said to be higher at senior levels. Racial discrimination in the U.S. Workforce continues to be a big issue, particularly among Asian Americans. Countries also seen a rise in anti-Asian violence. The killing of Michelle Goh in New York's Times Square in January is seen as part of a hate-driven attack against Asian Americans and has fueled this discussion about racial bias in the financial sector. Now joining us for our program is Colin Campbell, TV correspondent from Washington, D.C., and Mike Harris, editor at Veterans Today, joining us from Portland. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. Colin, we're going to start with you. Tell us what this study is all about.
Well, part of it is just looking at discrimination when it comes to Asian Americans and how it's sometimes can be challenging for them to climb the corporate ladder. However, I will say that throughout the most recent years in the U.S., Asians have been looked at largely as a model minority, and where we tend to look at discrimination and racial issues in a black and white lens, Asians add a different complexity to what we view as discrimination and the types of challenges that they face. At the same time, we do know that those threats against them and some of the discrimination and bigotry towards Asians and Asian Americans has increased since COVID was first learned of in our country, and we had a former president who usually referred to it as the Chinese flu. So then we started to see an increase against Asian Americans and attacks. And last year, Pew did a poll, and it suggested that about a third of Asian Americans feared physical threats and harm to themselves by other people extrinsic to their racial group. At the same time, 8 out of 10 Asian Americans believe that discrimination and violence towards them was on the rise. And we did see that playing out a little bit in U.S. media. There were some arrests made, and there was even some congressional legislation that was designed to really punish those who targeted Asians as a hate crime. So there was some legislation passed. Congress did take some movement on it. So it is being acknowledged, although it's far from being totally remedied.
Thank you, Colin. And Mike, I'd like to welcome you to the program here. Now, Mr. Mike Harris, so the law basically guarantees you a level playing field. So why are we not seeing that in practice?
That's a good question. I'm really glad to be addressing this topic because the United States as a country has been working under a broken paradigm for a long time in our race relations. And it's time that we took a new look at this. It came up with solutions that work. Because what we've been doing in the U.S. so far has not worked as far as getting toward racial equality. It just doesn't work. It's broken. The issue with the Asians is they're approximately 5.9% of the U.S. population, whereas blacks are 12.1%. So they're roughly 2-to-1 ratio. But the blacks are very vocal, very noisy, very bumptious about how they demand their rights, whereas the Asians are very quiet and demure and reserved. So they don't get the attention, they don't seek it. But the Asians outperform the blacks on every metric intellectually. So the Asians, as your earlier comment was that they are ideal, they're model citizens, they're model employees, and they work really well. The difficulty that they have is with, because of their cultural differences, asserting themselves into the corporate world where they can actually climb the ladder, where Asians and really Asian women are looked at as being hostile and aggressive if they assert themselves, where that standard is not held toward blacks. And the other thing that mitigates this, or makes it more difficult, acerbates it, I should say, is that most of the Asians in this country have immigrated since 1965. So they're a relatively recent transplant into our population over the last, 60, 70 years. So there's a lot of things, a lot of metrics. But the bottom line is, if we read the book, The Bell Curve, the greatest impact on cultural and financial success in our society is related to your IQ. The higher your IQ, the more money you'll make. Asians do exceptionally well in this. They've got the highest IQs on average among all the racial groups. Whites are second, blacks are a distant third. And so that's really what the nexus of this is how do we empower these people who are model citizens, model employees, to be able to reach the most of their potential in a culture that is a little bit difficult and different for them, and as yet is a new culture since they're such recent migrants into the USA.
All right, thank you, Mike. And Colin, so when you are from a racial group, basically any minority seems like has these struggles to try to be asserted in the workplace, to get a fair representation, to get their fair, what they should have coming to them, where a white male may have that coming to them a lot easier. So what are the avenues of recourse? I mean, are there some minority groups that aren't as litigious to Mike's point, where they know what avenues are available to them for them to try to fight for their rights, maybe get into the courts, maybe get representation with an attorney, maybe know what the laws are that give them certain protections? And how do you think that bears on the overall scenario here?
Yeah, we have to think, though, that in these cases, we have a system in America that was set up by white people, right? Which created a system of white hegemony, where you have other racial groups that are usually subjugated under this system that was created by the status quo. When you talk about the blacks, which is a very general term and somewhat derivative in its meaning and understanding, you have various black Americans, and then you have various black people that live in the United States. And so we have to make that designation. Now, when we're talking about the foundational black Americans who have always had to fight for any type of social advancement, you're going to see some more vociferous members of that group. But to characterize those who do make those assertions and fight for their rights and think that they aren't seen as antagonistic would be very ignorant of the understanding of what happens societally in the United States. One of the major tropes that many black Americans deal with here is the angry black woman and the angry black man. And we do remember James Baldwin, a famous poet, who said that to be black and American is to really be in a rage, to be black and conscious in America is to be in almost a rage all the time. So there is that stereotype there. Now, when it comes to Asian Americans, we have to remember the history of, say, Japanese people, for example, when they were put into concentration camps around World War II. They were given reparations. There was actually a congressional oversight committee during the Carter administration, later under the Reagan administration, where they studied how much money was taken from that community and how much they were owed. And so they were given some type of compensatory financial distribution for those for being put in a concentration camp. You don't really see this type of allowance legislatively when it comes to black Americans. In fact, H.R. 40, which would do the study of reparations for black Americans, is still somewhat of a dream when it comes to being addressed in a congressional way. So there are different types of recourse when it comes to discrimination for Asian Americans. We have seen some very recent legislative action when it comes to the hate crime bill against Asian Americans. That came about and was passed a lot quicker than the Lynching Act. And if we remember, if we know our history, lynching was a campaign that happened during the 1900s. So we're talking about a domestic terror campaign that has lasted for decades that finally got some redress in Congress, while the Asian hate crime bill was pretty recent and got passed pretty recently. So we can't say that the U.S. is not doing anything about it. Could it do more? Of course it could. But to say that it is so far behind, I would say, is not really accurate. We also have to look at some of the demographics when it comes to intelligence quotas in this country. When you look at Nigerians, for example, if they are part of that group called the Blacks, which they probably would not be since they're from Africa, they do actually tend to be intellectually on par with many Asian Americans. A lot of people don't know that. They kind of group a lot of Black Americans in together as a monolith, which would be, again, intellectually lazy. And so we have to get away from doing that.
Good stuff, Colin. Thank you. And Mr. Harris, so at this point, we don't have enough time to address all the minority groups, but there are Native Americans that I'm sure have, you know, a bone to pick. I'm sure there are Latino Americans that we could have probably pulled into this conversation. We just don't have simply enough time. But overall, how can minorities in America get recourse, get their fair share? How do you think lawmakers or policymakers could address this where there's a level playing field once they get in the corporate environment?
Let me address one thing first, and that is among white, and particularly white American males, the competition is fierce for these top jobs. I mean, it is really cutthroat, fierce competition. So don't think that just because you're a white guy, you get a free pass. You still have to be the best and brightest and most aggressive white guy to get the CEO job. That's something that many of these minorities seem to overlook, is that nobody's handing out CEO jobs. You have to fight for them. And if you're lucky enough to get one, you have to fight to keep it. So I don't think that any of the minority, whether it's Asian or Black or any American Indians, I don't think they really appreciate how competitive the field is amongst white Americans to get those positions. And that is something that really needs to be addressed, because it's not a walk in the park to walk into a company, work your way up to become the CEO. It's damn tough. But my only advice would be for everyone is to do your best, work hard, keep your nose to the grindstone, and don't take any crap off anybody. Work hard and push it, and make sure that your achievements and your things you do to advance yourself are recognized and noticed. And that is the way to get that.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you both for joining us. Colin Campbell from the U.S. Capitol and Mike Harris are joining us from Portland, Oregon. And that's a wrap for the segment of your news review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
While COVID-19 pandemic still takes toll in the United States, Biden has claimed that the pandemic is over in the country. According to data from the Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Resource Center in May, the United States officially surpassed 1 million COVID-19 deaths. The Biden's baseless claim has been rebuked by many in the U.S. and abroad. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Here's the story. Common Dreams website wrote, "What's ending here is political commitment and funding, not cases or deaths," said one medical anthropologist. President Joe Biden's fresh assertion that the pandemic is over, a claim made as COVID-19 kills roughly 3,000 people each week in the U.S. alone, is being criticized by progressive commentators and medical experts who argue that such false declarations undermine support for public health measures and bolster the GOP's effort to nix funding for vaccines, tests, and treatments. "We still have a problem with COVID," Biden acknowledged in a 60 Minutes interview aired recently, adding, "We are still doing a lot of work on it. But the pandemic is over," the president added. If you notice, no one's wearing masks. Everybody seems to be in pretty good shape, and so I think it's changing, he said. According to artist and writer R.T. Verkant, it's difficult to think of a clearer example of the sociological production of the end of the pandemic than the exchange between Biden and CBS Scott Pelley, which took place last week during Detroit's first annual auto show since 2019. A right-wing judge appointed by former President Donald Trump struck down the federal mask mandate for public transportation in April, but as MSNBC host Mehdi Hassan pointed recently, another key reason why most Americans have forgone masks in nearly all settings is because people like Biden keep falsely telling them the pandemic is over. Dr. Jonathan Rayner, a cardiologist and professor of medicine at George Washington University, asked on social media, "How do you convince Americans to get boosted again when the president declares the COVID pandemic is over?" The U.S. already has one of the lowest COVID-19 vaccination rates among high-income countries, and booster uptake has been especially low. While pervasive right-wing anti-science campaigns are certainly to blame, so too is the nation's deadly for-profit healthcare model, as well as mixed messaging that downplays the pandemic. Coronavirus mortality in the U.S. has decreased substantially since early in Biden's term, when more than 3,000 people were dying every day. The decline is inseparable from the increased availability of vaccines, tests, and treatments made possible by robust government funding. But roughly 400 people around the country continue to die from COVID-19 each day. Tens of thousands are hospitalized. Transmission remains high, and the White House is bracing for a potential surge in infections this fall, as money to address the ongoing crisis is drying up with no replenishments in sight. "What's ending here?" tweeted University of Washington medical anthropologist Nora Kenworthy. "Is political commitment and funding, not cases or deaths." Biden has asked federal lawmakers to appropriate $22.4 billion to support the fight against COVID-19. However, the president's apparently off-the-cuff remarks about the end of the pandemic may complicate his administration's so far unsuccessful efforts to secure additional funding from Congress for more coronavirus vaccines and treatments and to take other steps intended to combat the virus, the Washington Post noted. The newspaper reported Republicans raised questions about why the administration would renew its ongoing public health emergency if the pandemic is over. That emergency declaration, which is set to expire next month, has allowed federal officials to pursue flexible solutions amid the crisis, including rapidly authorizing new COVID treatments and keeping many Americans covered by Medicaid, the safety net health program. The Urban Institute, a think tank that conducts economic and social policy research, has estimated that as many as 15.8 million Americans could lose Medicaid coverage after the government ends its emergency declaration. According to Guardian, Biden says COVID pandemic is over, despite U.S. daily death toll in the hundreds. President says coronavirus is still a problem, but that circumstances are changing and everybody seems to be in pretty good shape. Joe Biden has claimed the pandemic is over in an interview broadcast, though he admitted we still have a problem with COVID as the U.S. continues to grapple with coronavirus infections that kill hundreds of Americans a day. The president told CBS 60 Minutes, we still have a problem with COVID. Last week, the World Health Organization declared the end of the pandemic was in sight after revealing that weekly deaths were at the lowest level since March 2020. However, it cautioned that coronavirus still posed an acute global emergency and highlighted that during the first 8 months of 2022, more than 1 million people died from COVID-19. In the U.S., the toll of the pandemic has diminished significantly since early in Biden's term, when more than 3,000 Americans a day were dying as enhanced care, medications, and vaccinations have become more widely available. But nearly 400 people a day continue to die from COVID in the U.S., according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Biden spent more than 2 weeks isolating in the White House after two bouts of COVID starting in July. His wife, Jill, contracted the virus in August. Biden has said the mild cases were a testament to the improvements in care during his presidency.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss your queries regarding the upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have with us our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad. He's an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for accepting the invitation. Well, Brother Miqdad, in our previous sessions, we have been talking about the animation world, the games world, and what kind of worldview they portray and how a parent should be aware about that. You gave us a few examples. I want to ask you, is there any more worldview that's being portrayed, or are there more examples you would like to add?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So we've been talking about bringing awareness to parents as well as youth about the dangers of the screen. So screen being animations or video games or cartoons or movies or serials, whatever it is. And we said that the first thing that we need to understand is that we need to be concerned, right? Okay. What we're going to do about this is another discussion. It's a different chapter in this book. But the first thing that we want to do is really understand and be aware that this is something concerning that we need to be aware of, that we cannot by any means leave our children on the screen unsupervised for hours long without knowing what they're getting involved in. And just saying that there's no adult content in it is not sufficient at all. So in the previous show, we talked about how the screen is an education. It's not just pure entertainment. In most of the time, at the very least, we can say in most times, in most circumstances, the screen, so video games or animations or serials, are not pure and just empty entertainment, but rather it's an education. It changes the way we think. It changes our values, our goals, our principles in life.
Yeah.
And so this worldview, how it's changed, we talked about a few examples in the previous show. We talked about Moana Entangled in the theme of girls being free.
Yeah.
We talked about sandbox game like Minecraft.
True.
To give a couple more examples and then move on, the example of how we define or how we understand the importance of success and how to get to success.
All right.
So one of the themes that you find that's portrayed out there that changed our worldview mm-hmm. is this attitude of, or this is this theme that luck is very important and that we don't need as much effort as we need luck in becoming successful.
All right. So it's your fortune that will take you, that will define your destiny.
That's correct.
All right.
So you find that today's culture is kind of governed by this idea that we all want to become a millionaire overnight.
All right.
So the whole worldview out there is effort is good, but we're always chasing this overnight millionaire. That something will just lucky, something will happen out of luck and we'll just get to something. And you find that this then goes into other areas, not just material areas. And you find that, for example, just to give an idea, if you look at all the superheroes that we have out there, right? So Ben 10 and Spider-Man and Superman and what you name all of them, you find that in 90% of the superheroes, if not all of them, their human perfection, or let's say the perfection that they have, is never out of an effort that they've made.
All right.
It's always out of a luck. So whether they found a watch, or they were bitten by a spider, or they came from a random place, or something random and purely fortune happened to them that made them achieve a type of perfection that other human beings don't have.
All right.
And so this is completely opposite to what we say real in Islam.
Life.
Yeah, or in real life as well.
Yeah.
So in Islam, we have this idea that it is efforts that lead you to perfection, right?
All right.
وَلَيْسَ لِلْإِنسَانِ إِلَّا مَا سَعَى. Human being doesn't have anything except what he gains through his efforts, through his actions.
Exactly. We'll talk more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Brother Miqdad, and we're discussing about animations, video games, and what kind of effects these screens have for children, or what kind of world view is being portrayed. Yes, Brother Miqdad, you said so far that we are being introduced to the games in which girls have to be free, they have to go against all the norms, all the beliefs, all the ideas and values. And there are games that show you there should be there's no purpose in life, you have to design it yourself. And we also came to the point that you have to wait for luck. Fortune defines your destiny, it's not much of your efforts, which is very opposite to what is being taught in Islam.
So these were three examples that I gave. So on this last example, if you look at, perhaps somebody might ask, but what about the Ahlul Bayt, for example? Haven't they received this human perfection from birth? And the answer is yes, but it was based on their efforts as well. It is based on the fact that Allah knew that they will perform the best of actions in this world. So even in the case of the Ahlul Bayt, their human perfection that they've achieved, and them being true superheroes, it is not out of luck. It is rather out of their actions that they commit and they perform in this world that leads them to that highest level of human perfection.
True.
Inshallah, you can refer to more on books of Aqaid, but this is the true Islamic worldview, that what human perfection we can achieve, how to become superheroes, how to be successful, is through our effort and not through luck. So this is another example. Another example we can talk about is this idea that everything is material, and there is no reality other than material reality. So this is a very common thing you find in all, if not most, of the things that we interact with on the screen, because the producers of these animations and video games and serials, etc., are from a secular background. They're from empiristic and modern background, which means that they believe that reality is that which is sensed in with the five senses, and that we have no reality beyond that which is material.
All right.
So just to give an example, in Ice Age, right? Ice Age 3, if I remember correctly, heaven, how is heaven portrayed? Heaven is a world, a material world with material pleasure, right? Take the example of Up, where you find that they, throughout the movie, throughout the animation, they're searching for this heavenly garden, you would call, right?
Okay.
Not only to realize that that wasn't what was important. What was important was what they had in this world.
All right.
So at the end, if you remember the end of the animation, they come back to this world and say, that which we have was very beautiful. That which we had in this world was very important.
All right, then actually reversing the concept
exactly
that is being taught in Islam. All right, there's more to talk on this, and we'll talk about that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "No father has granted a gift to his child better than good manners."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Brother Miqdad, and we are talking about video games, animations, what kind of effects it have on children, and what is the Islamic worldview. Well, Brother Miqdad, in our previous episodes, you talked about a few things that were changing the mindset of girls. You said that there are a few games that show that girls, the definition of free is being defined as girls must go against the norms, against their parents, against the beliefs that they carry or their parents have, against all the rituals that are existing in their societies, against the values. I want to ask you here, What does Islam say? Does Islam restrict girls?
The answer to that is no. So obviously, the Islamic idea of successful woman is the same as a success for a man, because success in Islamic terms is not gender limited.
Okay.
So the human perfection that a man can achieve is the same perfection that a woman can achieve. So, and you have examples and role models for that in the Holy Quran as well. So Hazrat Zahra is obviously a pure role model for human perfection that is achieved. She is the same as Amir al-Mu'minin. She is kuf for Amir al-Mu'minin, Imam Ali alayhi salam, which means that their human perfection is at the highest level that can be achieved.
All right.
The Holy Quran, for example, you have the example of Maryam alayhi salam and the wife of Fir'aun, both of whom are role models for not just women, but believers. In the Holy Quran, the word that is used for them too is that both of them are role models for believers, men and women. Doesn't make a difference.
Doesn't make any difference.
The gender gender in terms of human perfection has no is not a limitation. However, when it comes to the path towards achieving that perfection, because the world is such that there is differences in these two genders when it comes to the material world, so.
Yeah.
Responsibilities at the level of society, family, etc., are different. Therefore, the path upon which both of these genders have to track on might look different in some ways, and this will lead to laws being also different for men and women.
Exactly.
When it comes to, especially when it comes to laws that are related to society, just because there's differences between them, but that which they can achieve is the same in terms of that high level of perfection.
Exactly. And also about these two pious ladies, Surah Tahrim says that it's not necessary that a woman to be a role model has to be a wife of a prophet, because Maryam was not wife of any prophet and Lady Asiya was wife of Fir'aun. So they can be role models as such, like on their own, independently, reaching that highest perfection. Thank you so much, Brother Miksad, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
As the U.S. continues its efforts to prolong the crisis in Eastern Europe, the European continent faces the grim prospect of deindustrialization and deep recession. The question that comes to mind is that why should European households pay for a conflict which is instigated by the U.S. regime? In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media websites for further details. Stay tuned, please. Global Times wrote, "Deindustrialization, which has been hotly discussed in Europe recently, overshadows the efforts of Western developed countries to rebuild their industrialization. Deindustrialization is not new in Western countries. Since 1970s, industries in Europe and the US have been moving out of their countries for comprehensive reasons. But the newest wave of deindustrialization Europe is facing this time is largely influenced by a single effect, that is, rising energy prices and imported inflation, further exposing all old problems that already existed. Now, electricity and gas prices have soared because of Russia-Ukraine crisis. In an open letter to EU leaders, including Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, European Industry Association, Euromax, raised the alarm about Europe's escalating energy crisis posing an existential threat to industry, calling on EU and member state leaders to take emergency action to preserve their strategic electricity-intensive industries and prevent permanent job losses. Global Times added, growing costs will cause a lack of industrial raw materials in Europe, including metals. Together with soaring energy prices, as well as the rise in import prices, due to the devaluation of the euro, the decline of profit margins will bring troubles to both the enterprises and the broader manufacturing industry. As a result, the effects of the Russia-Ukraine crisis are another burden on Europe's unresolved problem of past deindustrialization. Of course, decision-making errors also contribute to the current energy shortage in Europe, with some countries having put forward radical energy transition goals, including the decision to phase out nuclear power, the negative impact of which has just been catalyzed by the crisis in Ukraine. Facing energy difficulties, some European countries were forced to boost coal use or extend the life of some nuclear reactors, which now leave them further away from Europe's earlier energy ambitions. Wang Xu, a professor at the School of International Relations of Beijing Foreign Studies University, told the Global Times. Moreover, the EU had proposed a ban on long-term contracts to import natural gas into the bloc to end its reliance on foreign producers before the Russia-Ukraine crisis broke out, leaving no access for temporary purchases now. If the German economy, the engine of European economy, slows down while its export-oriented model is hit, the entire Eurozone economy will be affected, likely resulting in a technical recession in Europe from next year, according to Wang. What's worse, there is not much hope for Europe to come up with any solutions in the next few years for energy shortages. Governments in the EU may have to turn to subsidies in facing higher prices of electricity, gas and oil, which draws another problem of where does the money comes from. Meanwhile, the European Central Bank has announced measures to tighten monetary policy in response to growing inflation, a policy which contradicts the proposal of potential large-scale subsidies. As a result, there is limited policy space for Europe, which will suffer more if the energy crisis drags on as the Russia-Ukraine conflict continues to prolong and escalate. However, Europe, despite being an important stakeholder during this crisis, does not have the ability to address the problem since it is unable to influence the resolution of the conflict. Indeed, there will be growing coordination between U.S. and Europe in terms of monetary and economic policies due to the U.S. concerns the conflict brings about broader global market turmoil and affects U.S. interests. But current U.S. policy seems to be deliberately pushing the world further toward a crisis rather than easing it, given that the Federal Reserve has just raised interest rates by 75 basis points for the third consecutive time. In doing so, it is using its monetary policy to pass on its domestic economic crisis to other countries. Furthermore, once the growing deindustrialization of Europe becomes a reality, the U.S. may try to benefit from it by promoting the trend, because the U.S. will become a preferential destination of European industries that choose to leave the continent. This is the last thing Europeans want to see, which is to pay for the Russia-Ukraine conflict instigated by the U.S. regime. According to Forbes, with natural gas prices over $100 more per megawatt hour than they were a year ago, the Western European economies are heading to the Middle Ages. Forests are being cut for firewood as Russia retaliates with its own Ukraine crisis sanctions by shutting off the trickle of natural gas. It was still piping into Europe. Germany, watching companies suffer high electricity bills, and is finally talking about decoupling from China. The energy crisis is making them nervous. They want to make it harder for manufacturers to outsource now that their energy bill is at an all-time high. This no longer looks like a short-term crisis. Stories from Western Europe are like stories one once heard in countries like Bolivia. High inflation and resource rations imposed by the state. Corporate investment goes where money goes farthest. It used to be taxes and labor and environmental costs they looked at. Now European companies will add electricity to the mix. None of this bodes well for European businesses. For this reason, new UK Prime Minister Liz Truss has given up listening to the climate lobby and said the country would end its fracking ban. Britain is in the same boat as the EU. Brexit didn't shield it from Europe's policy errors. Germany is signing long-term contracts for US LNG to save itself, though it will have to find a place to put it all. For this reason, they will have to build new terminals to handle those shipments quickly. But these actions should have been done years ago, or at least set in place before the Russian sanctions were announced. Europe had no ace up its sleeves. We now expect a deeper prolonged recession and more persistent elevated inflation due to the impact of higher energy prices, a more decisive European Central Bank tightening cycle and weaker demand, says Barclays Capital Economist, led by Silvia Ardana. According to Forbes, the European Central Bank raised its main leading rate 75 basis points to 1.25% last week. That's still historically low. But the EU economy has been so used to near zero rates that liquidity will start to dry up as capital costs rise. As the margin, traders will think twice about buying securities on leverage, among other things. Vanguard's FTSE Europe is not a buy. This looks like the classic dead cat bounce. Barclays forecasts a Eurozone recession in the fourth quarter that will persist until the second quarter of 2023, with a 1.7% contraction in real GDP. Some countries will be worse off than others. Barclays revised their growth rate down in January. Italy, France, and Spain. Germany will be the worst due to its high reliance on Russian gas and bottlenecks in transporting gas within Europe. Most pipe gas is from Russia. Italy is the second worst performer because it is highly dependent on natural gas to generate electricity, using it for about 50% of power generation. These factors mean Germany and Italy are more likely to face physical shortages, while the energy crisis represents more of a price shock for France than Spain, Barclays economists wrote recently. Inflation in Europe should peak at 9.3% in the fourth quarter. Barclays says that domestic drivers of medium-term inflation now look weaker than they did in June as demand slows and real incomes fall flat. Europeans will be spending a lot on fuel. Natural gas prices are up by around $170 per megawatt hour over the last 12 months. In the U.S., the experts measure natural gas price by British thermal unit. Prices closed at $8.81 per million BTU for the nearby futures contract, while EU natural gas is around $50 per million BTU. Despite these inflationary headwinds, the ECB is seen raising rates by 75 percent points in October to fight inflation.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.